Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim, what's on today's agenda?
Well, Steve, it's almost like part one of a two-part series. Today, we're going to look at the challenge of getting a spacecraft into orbit and then further to the moon or Mars. Next week, we'll be looking at how to make space travel more affordable. But first, somebody had to figure out how to push anything far enough and fast enough to reach orbit.
But you know, Tim, before we get into how to put something into space, I would like to take a look at the word shipping and its derivation, because we talk about rocket ships and spaceships. But the idea of shipping actually began over 5,000 years ago, and I find that hard to believe. 5,000 years ago, when merchants realized that sending products by water was much cheaper and faster than doing it by land. And of course, this meant putting their products on ships, from which the term shipping is therefore derived. But the next big jump, or the next big innovation, was to supplement the river current with a propulsion of some sort, be it poles and oars, and then finally came sails. So there was a 5,000-year gap up to about the year 1800, and the Industrial Revolution saw the advent of coal-fired steam engines on ships powering side-mounted paddle wheels. And yet, within 10 years, from 1800 to 1810, ships were now being designed with actual propellers as we know of them today. And from 1810 on, the only real practical change to shipping has been the introduction of an internal combustion engine, such as a diesel, powering those propellers. Four atomic-powered ships, such as the USS Savannah, launched in 1959, have been built, but considering all factors, such as the initial cost and the refusal of nuclear-free zone countries such as Australia, New Zealand, and indeed the Port of Vancouver to refuse their admittance, means that, by and large, nuclear-powered ships have proven to be uneconomical.
So, Steve, that's a bit of a history lesson on the origin of shipping. You're going to have to connect the dots now to how that applies to space capsules.
You're right, Tim. And listeners might recall last episode's topic of science fiction movies, and no self-respecting B-movie would have been complete without the brand new of the time concept of rocket ships. And I'm not sure where the term rocket ship originated, but the Collier's Weekly magazine certainly brought rocket ships to the public's attention with its three-issue Man on the Moon series, which was first published October 18, 1952. And Walt Disney capitalized upon the popularity in 1955 by featuring a Man in Space TV series narrated by Wernher von Braun as he stood beside a, quote, orbital rocket ship. Listeners may not be aware that this is the same von Braun who invented the V-2 rocket in World War II, of which some 3,170 were launched, with Belgian cities being hit by over 1,600 of them, followed by England hit with 1,400 V-2s, France with 76, and the Netherlands with 19.
Well, you're right. Wernher von Braun had been a leading part of Germany's rocket science team in World War II. And then here we are, there we were back in the 50s, with him standing beside a peacetime rocket ship on Walt Disney's Disneyland, as it was then known. And I just have to think it must have been a bit of a disconnect for any veterans that had been watching. But we've learned since that during the Cold War, both sides actually did their level best to get as many of those rocket scientists and expertise as they could. For interested listeners, they might want to do a little research on Operation Paperclip, which actually secreted a large number of German scientists and technologists into the United States immediately after the war. But even with the best and the brightest minds that they could gather together, it's not like the path forward was easy for either the Russians or the Americans.
And with reference to the terms rocket ship and spaceship, the two may seem synonymous, and to me they were, but a little research shows that nowadays the term rocket is reserved for the first or second unmanned booster, while spaceship refers to a live crewed assembly. However, back in the day, everyone assumed that the first manned flights would be in a quote-unquote rocket ship, and we all knew what they were going to look like.
We certainly did, and it's a reasonable premise that people had to expect that. If you think of names like Chuck Yeager, Back in the 1950s, there was lots of news about the speed of sound being broken by Chuck Yeager and his colleagues, and phrases like pushing the envelope and planes going higher and faster. And it would be quite reasonable to say, well, why not just build a bigger plane with a faster jet engine and get into space that way?
Well, that certainly seems reasonable, Tim, but unfortunately, science dictates a different answer. Jet engines do operate much more efficiently at high altitudes compared to being at a sea level. And the optimal cruise altitude for a jet engine is somewhere around 36,000 feet, because at that height, the air is denser and cooler than at sea level. And so combustion and thrust are optimized. However, as that altitude increases to over, let's say 60,000 feet or so, the air hardly supports combustion and provides little lift. And the jet-powered U-2 has flown as high as 80,000 feet, shall we say. Its successor, the SR-71, flew to 85,000 feet, and that's about 25 kilometers up in the sky. However, these are very difficult to fly exotic aircraft. And more importantly, space is defined as starting at not 25 kilometers, but 100 kilometers, a full 75 kilometers above those two exotic airplanes' capabilities. To reach space in a plane with wings requires rockets, and that's exactly what the rocket-propelled X-15 did in 1963, piloted by Joseph Walker, when he reached an altitude of 107 kilometers, and he became an astronaut in doing so.
People had an image of what space travel was going to be, and it was a far cry from what turned out to be the case.
Comic book fans of the intrepid Belgian reporter Tintin have an excellent visual of what such a rocket ship would look like, as it featured prominently in the 1953 Destination Moon series, which has been in reprint several times, and it's been made into an animated feature. And guess what? You can see that on YouTube.
And that's a far cry from what the reality was. In practice, there was a missile with a tiny separate workspace, barely big enough for a full-grown man. That's how we got into space.
You've got speed, John Glenn. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Roger, the clock is operating. We're underway.
Loud and clear.
Roger, we're programming and roll okay. A little bumpy along about here.
Roger. Stand by for 20 seconds.
Roger.
2, 1, mark.
Roger, backup clock is started.
The one major factor in the early space program was developing a single-stage booster with enough thrust to put not only the object, such as a satellite, into space, but a capsule with the extra weight of the humans, redundant safety systems, oxygen systems, and a recovery system. All of these human-rated requirements, well, they added weight, a lot of weight, and so the reduction of weight, wherever possible, was of paramount importance. That was the real world. The Americans chose not to call their project either a rocket ship or a spaceship, opting to call it instead a capsule.
Well, with the Soviets, or the Russians, if you will, weight reduction wasn't quite as paramount for them, because their rocket booster had a total thrust of 3,800 kilonewtons compared to the American Redstone rocket, which had a relatively paltry 350 kilonewtons, virtually a tenth of its rival. As a result, Vostok, which was Russia's first space capsule, had a mass of 2,460 kilograms, a clear 1,000 kilograms more than its American counterpart, Mercury. Now, to say that Mercury was small would be an understatement, as its outside diameters were only 2 meters in height, 2 meters wide, and inside, the astronaut had a mere 2.8 cubic meters of space. If you're like me, Tim, I really don't know what 2.8 meters of space is, and so I did a little research and put it into perspective. That's a third less than the interior passenger room of a Subaru Outback. And yet all returned, not by landing on wheels or on their tail, no, all returned by splashing down in the ocean after deploying a trio of parachutes. Now, because of geographical practicalities, the Soviets couldn't land on water. they landed on the land. And the Vostok capsule that they used had no soft landing capability. Now, this was kept highly secret because FAA, which was responsible for recognizing air and space achievements, wouldn't have counted Yuri Gagarin's 1961 flight as being the first into space because, according to their rules, the pilot must land aboard his ship.
Playing a little fast and loose with the rules, were they? Well, in 1967, the Soviets launched their Soyuz two-man space capsule using a booster of 994 kilonewtons. And by this time, the Americans had caught up and passed them. They were using the Titan II ICBM booster with a substantial increase from Redstone's 350 kilonewtons to 1900, enabling them to build the larger two-man Gemini spacecraft. The Gemini was significantly bigger in both regards. It was 5.6 meters high and 3 meters wide. So they had the ability to have ejection seats, windows, onboard computers. Though larger than the single-seat Mercury, Gemini held two astronauts, and subsequently each actually had less room than they did in the earlier spacecraft. Incidentally, the Gemini crew capsule was officially called the reentry module.
So the Gemini program of 11 space flights allowed the U.S. to take a lead in the space race by perfecting our rendezvous techniques, and those were necessary for staging to go to the moon under the Apollo program.
It's kind of odd that the Soviets lost ground because of their advantage in ability to get a higher weight volume into space, but they continued to use the Vostok capsule and the Vostok rocket booster, insistent on using a technology that would go on to become the most reliable and cost-effective way to get a spacecraft into space.
That's right. And next episode, we're going to take a look at some of that cost analysis. So the Americans raised the ante with their moon missions using the Saturn V booster and the Apollo three-man spacecraft. Saturn's huge 34,500 kilonewtons of thrust allowed the capsule to grow in size to 6 meters in height, 4 meters in width, with an interior space of 5.9 cubic meters, 1.5 times the interior space of that same Subaru Outback.
Well, the space capsules may have gotten larger, but they all return via parachutes, be it on land or sea. The concept of landing a spaceship, as imagined in sci-fi movies, didn't happen until 1981, and that was with the launch of the first space shuttle, commanded by astronaut extraordinaire John Young, who was certainly one of my favorites and is the most accomplished of all space pilots, being the only one to pilot four different classes of spacecraft. On a Gemini flight, an Apollo flight where he commanded it, and the service module, which is the Apollo lunar module, and the space shuttle.
And so to recap from a spacecraft evolutionary point of view, it took 20 years of development from Gagarin's 1961 flight, which ended when he jumped out and parachuted from the Soyuz, to John Young's 1981 space shuttle flight landing horizontally on wheels like Flash Gordon's did on movie screens in the 1930s.
Now I'd like to shift our focus to the amazing new spacecraft on the scene today and the arrival of spacecraft that actually meet up to the imaginations of people in the early 20th century. So let's just start with a quick overview of what's on tap for the 2020s. The Russians have essentially walked away from spacecraft that could carry cosmonauts beyond low Earth orbit, but not the Chinese. They have been completing their own space station, and their latest launch vehicles, the Long March 9, competes on every measure in terms of thrust and payload capacities. NASA is very active again, too, in terms of human space travel. The Artemis rocket and Orion spacecraft are on the cusp of returning humans to the lunar surface in just a couple of years. And then there are the private sector entrants, such as Blue Origin, that comes from Amazon and Jeff Bezos and his fortune, or Elon Musk and SpaceX, and the continued growth of United Launch Alliance. It's been a long time coming, but that giant leap forward promised by Neil Armstrong back in the day seems to be at hand.
Well, you can be quite the optimist, Tim. Are you actually ready to cheer on the likes of the Chinese, Elon Musk, and Jeff Bezos? I'm not alarmed at the prospects per se, but I'm not really thrilled about it. Convince me, how do you see this working out?
How about this? I'll ask you what you'd like to see in terms of the future of space travel, and I'll see if the current dance card of new and nearly ready to fly spacecraft measure up. Let's be honest here. You're a little bit younger than William Shatner was when he went on that suborbital flight on Blue Origin a couple of years ago. But let's put you on a flight to the moon. What's something you'd like to see on that flight that wasn't available, say, on the Apollo flights, or at least was pretty basic back then?
Safety has to be a primary concern. I say that because I remember back in 1967 when Apollo 1 lost all three crew on the launch pad in a fire. And in 1970, Apollo 13 almost lost its crew of three. And with NASA's Space Shuttle Challenger loss in 1986 in Columbia in 2003, 14 astronauts died in those two. I surely would have concerns about flying to the moon. What assurances for safety do you think have been built in?
Well, first off, you're going to feel good about the launch abort systems. It sounds like a funny way to put it, but it's one of the great risks in space travel is just getting that massive rocket safely into orbit. And if something goes wrong at liftoff, what does that mean about the human cargo? How does it get away safely? All the spacecraft that I looked into are now boasting new systems to get the job done. The one that I thought was most interesting was aboard the Artemis Orion system. Orion, being the space capsule, sits atop the launch system, the Artemis, but it has a combination of rockets with 400,000 pounds of thrust that's designed to pull Orion up and away from the Artemis rocket, tested and true. Then, when you're circling the Earth, waiting for that translunar insertion, you'll notice you're breathing some pretty clean air, almost no odor. All the craft that I reviewed boasted new environmental systems that are going to keep the air crisp and clean. And if you're worried about something crucial breaking and no spare parts, no Canadian Tire within sight, well, what are you going to do? Well, if you're on board the SpaceX Starship, it's not going to be a big deal. They're taking along with them a significant capacity of 3D printing. And standard operating equipment now includes significant protection against micrometeoroids and solar radiation. And one of the really neat ones I read about was the Orion spacecraft has a homing device on the spacecraft that will aim the spacecraft towards the sun in an emergency. And that's a way to ensure that its solar panels are still working and can keep the systems on board powered up. So what else would you like, Steve?
Back in the early days, the most typical question asked of the early astronauts was of, shall we say, bodily functions. Well, Tim, I remember asking my dad back in the day about having to go to the bathroom when he was flying a plane, and he mentioned that there was a relief tube or a urine tube, which the pilot used by unbuckling himself and using the device shaped like a funnel, which dribbled the contents from the body out to the great blue skies. And in that most fighter plane missions were less than 2 hours duration, the issue of bowel movements was addressed and averted by eating high-protein meals prior to flight to avoid the, shall we say, urge to purge. On a more, shall we say, esoteric level, what about creature comforts such as the internet? Is there Wi-Fi in space?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Steve, and I've got that covered too, or at least these new spacecraft do. I haven't really mentioned the Boeing entrant. That one's called the Starliner. And it's actually a spacecraft that piggybacks on top of somebody else's rocket, such as the United Launch Alliance Atlas V. So on board, Wi-Fi. And the crew gets tablets, and they have touchscreen monitors for communications. And get this, I love this partnership between NASA and Amazon. They've been working on the Wi-Fi challenge as well. And guess what? On board the Orion, they'll have Alexa. But sure, all the new spacecraft are upping their game when it comes to internet connectivity. So, are you happy yet? What else would you like to see on board as you approach lunar orbit insertion?
Well, Tim, I must admit, I'm not as big and strong as I used to be, and I've grown accustomed to, shall we say, creature comforts. And so for softies such as myself, what else might there be up there after a long, busy day of being launched into orbit? I want to kick back and have some quality time. What have you got for me?
Just a second. I'm just going to pick up some of the brochures, the travel brochures they're putting out for these space flights. On board the Orion, you can keep your fitness with strength and aerobic machines. And the views are great too, especially with six windows for just four astronauts. Each window made of an acrylic compound with shades and three lighting modes. But the real luxury comes on board SpaceX Starship, and why not? We'll be seeing the debut flight of this in a couple of months, I hope. It's got the capacity to have 40 cabins, 100 astronauts, reclining seats, large screens for entertainment, a private restroom at the back of the cabin that is similar but larger than what you'd find on an airplane. Oh, yes, and a water dispenser. Altogether, one sweet ride.
It sounds tempting, and it's a far cry from the cramped quarters on board Gemini, Apollo, and Mercury. When you're describing those features on the spaceship Starship, you make it sound more like a souped-up Concorde, which was rather cramped, than a spacecraft. We've come a long way. You know, you're saying 40 cabins, 100 passengers?
Well, Elon Musk, he's obviously both a dreamer and a business guy. There's talk that the plans for SpaceX Starship actually include point-to-point flights on planet Earth, say a trip from America to Asia. A few years ago, I think it was 2018, Musk was talking about suborbital flights taking passengers at Mach 25 around the world, nearly 30,000 kilometers per hour. And the only downside? Flights will be so short, there'll be no onboard service.
And, you know, the interesting thing about going Mach 25, the amount of time that it takes to reach Mach 25, and then you travel at Mach 25, you must account for the same amount of time to reduce your speed from Mach 25 down to zero. So let's say it takes 40 minutes to get to that speed. You have to allow 40 minutes to get down from that speed. So that's 80 minutes, and then there's your flight time. So let's put the travel brochures down and talk a little about the way these spacecraft will get to orbit, how they stack up against one another, and for that matter, compared to the mighty Saturn V that took the astronauts to the moon. You know, I've been curious about the choices of the rocket fuel that they're going to be using. Now, a rocket fuel usually consists of two parts, the reducing agent, which is actually the fuel, and an oxidizer. Let's start with the United Launch Alliance Atlas V. And that's the rocket system that's been in use for some time. It's also the rocket that's being used by Boeing to get their new Starliner into low Earth orbit, sending crews and supplies to the ISS. So it's tried and true, with the core fuel being a mixture of liquid oxygen as the oxidizer and liquid kerosene. So in May of this year, the new United Launch Alliance rocket will make its debut, and it's going to be called the Vulcan Centaur, capable of putting a payload of some 30,000 kilos into low Earth orbit. This new rocket is going to switch from liquid oxygen and kerosene to liquid oxygen and methane. And that's the same fuel combination that SpaceX will be using for its Starship, by the way.
Well, I've read that the Chinese rocket, the Long March 9, it's going to be burning a more traditional liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen mix. Have you been reading about that rocket too, Steve, and how it might compare?
I like the name, first of all, Long March, which of course refers to the communist Red Army marching against Chiang Kai-shek's forces and becoming victorious, which is why it's called the Long March. It stands 114 meters tall, 3 meters higher than the old Saturn V, and it's a bit taller than the Artemis 1 at 98 meters. The biggest of them all is going to be SpaceX's Starship at 120 meters. One of the most common measures used has always been the mass of the payload that could be delivered into low Earth orbit. Unfortunately, a combination of factors have made this a more complicated metric. I think for our purposes, it's best to step back and round things off a bit. So let's say the Artemis rocket will carry about double the payload of the old Saturn V. But both the Long March 9 and Starship will carry triple the payload.
Well, you've been doing the reading on this, Steve, on these rockets. Is there perhaps one factoid that kind of jumps off the page for you?
Well, yes, there is, Tim, and that's going to be the launch of SpaceX's Starship sometime this spring or perhaps in the summer. Now, we're all familiar with the old space shuttle lifting off with two booster rockets strapped to the sides and three liquids in the center. Starship doesn't have two or three. It's got 33 rockets inside the main booster as part of a two-stage rocket.
Quite incredible. But that's all the time we have today on Space Talks. And tune in again next week when our topic will be the economics of spaceflight. We'd like to hear your comments, questions, and suggestions, which can be sent to us at spacetalks@voiceoftheshooshwap.ca. And until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on Space Talks.